Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. Subscribe to SubChina's daily access newsletter to keep on top of all the latest news from China from hundreds of different news sources, or check out all the original writing on our site at subchina.com. We've got reported stories, we've got editorials, regular columns, a growing library of videos, and of course, our network of podcasts. We cover everything from China's fraught foreign relations to its ingenious entrepreneurs, from the ongoing repression of Uyghurs and other Muslim people in China's Xinjiang region to China's ambitious effort to eliminate poverty. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. We cover China with neither fear nor favor. I am Kaiser Guo. I am coming to you from my home in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. This week, it's the return of El Maíz Dorado, the man with the golden corn, Mr. Jin Yumi. And Jeremy, it's your birthday today. Feliz cumpleaños, amigo. Shengri Kuaile, etc.
Thank you very much.
I'm not going to say which birthday it is, though. I know, because you ladies want to.
75.
Right, 75, something close to that. Greet the people. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good. Beautiful day here in Nashville.
Well, what better way to celebrate than talking about the history of diplomacy in the PRC, right?
Oh, yeah. What a totally delightful subject. But I actually mean that because... we don't have a lot of ways of understanding how the Chinese government is thinking. You know, we have propaganda, we have sort of semi-propaganda, commercial media, and we have diplomats. They're one of the few sources of information sort of from the heart of the beast. So It's a really fascinating subject.
Well, today we are delighted to be joined by one Peter Martin, correspondent for Bloomberg and author of a highly readable and quite insightful book all about China's diplomacy, China's Civilian Army, The Making of Wolf Warrior Diplomacy, which has just come out in its second print run globally. It draws on extensive interviews as well as archival work and the published Chinese language memoirs of many retired diplomats. Last week, as you remember, we ran an interview that I actually recorded in late July with Ambassador Huang Ping, who is Consul General to China's New York consulate. And as promised in that show, we were going to talk about what Ambassador Huang had to say and how it squares with what Pete describes in his book. Peter Martin, welcome to Cynica.
Thanks so much for having me.
Delighted. Your book, Pete, goes all the way back to the party's very early days, and especially the Zhou Enlai's role in shaping the party's diplomatic history. And we are going to talk about Zhou Enlai, but before we get to him, let's go back a little bit further and talk about the state of diplomatic infrastructure during the Qing Dynasty, you know, even before the Opium War. So in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, how it developed also in the final decades, the last century of the dynasty, the origins of the Zhongli Yamen, this kind of improvised way that the Qing had to conduct its foreign affairs and so forth. What were things like for the diplomats back then?
So basically, you need to think of foreign ministries as a European institution. This is something that developed in 19th century Europe and spread around the world. And so for countries outside of Europe, including Qing China, this was kind of an alien approach to foreign affairs, to have one centralized ministry in charge of dealing with all foreign countries. And that was true for the Qing. So you had different departments tasked with dealing with different parts of the world according to their status and kind of the function that they served for the Qing court. It was really only after the Second Opium War that you had this kind of proto-foreign ministry called the Zhongli Yamen, which was developed. And then after the Boxer Protocols, that China developed a foreign ministry in a form that we would kind of recognize today. I think that's pretty telling, actually. the idea that China's modern diplomatic infrastructure was born out of two of the most humiliating instances in modern Chinese history kind of tells you something about the foundational psychologies that matter there.
Yeah, for sure. And we'll talk about the narrative of national humiliation, which is, you know, very key to all of that.
So, Pete, a few weeks ago, around the time I was finishing your book, a reader sent me an email titled something like The Original Wolf Warriors, and it had some photos taken outside the Chinese embassy in London in 1967, when embassy staff bearing cudgels got into a physical confrontation with British journalists and police. And it was a good reminder of why your book title makes sense and made sense even before more recent use of the word, you know, before the term wolf warrior was coined. But the person who really shaped the behavior, even of those cudgel-bearing diplomats back then, was actually cuddly old Zhou Enlai, the man who's often portrayed as the sort of the guy who made Maoist China human. And he is, he's the main character of your book in many ways, as you trace the historical underpinnings of Chinese diplomacy and, you know, his shaping of the Communist Party's first generation of diplomats. So he is canonized as the Communist Party's last perfect revolutionary. But could you say a little more about his early life and some of the events or experiences that shaped his thinking on how diplomacy should be managed and conducted?
Yeah, of course. So Zhou was born in the late 19th century to a kind of genteel family that had hit on hard times. He was raised by an aunt who was incredibly devoted and doting toward him. And he witnessed China go through this kind of diplomatic and national nadir that we discussed just now. And in that kind of environment, Zhou was drawn to Marxism. So when he studied abroad and lived in Japan, Germany, France, briefly visited England, he began to develop Marxist ideas and eventually became one of the earlier members of the Communist Party, helping to start a Paris branch for it. And Zhou, from, you know, that very early period, was intrigued about the need for the party to build international ties and to reach out to the outside world as a source of strength.
We'll talk a little bit more about what Zhou Enlai's role was. The early chapters of your book, though, they focus on, you know, this, as we said, this centrality of the narrative of national humiliation and how it really informed and keeps on informing the conception and the practice of diplomacy in China. Not that, you know, national humiliation, I should remind people, was the sole preserve of the communists. I think it's good to remember that Chiang Kai-shek himself, for 20 years, wrote "Avenge Humiliation" in his diary every single day. So yeah, I mean, it's a pretty key piece of it. And you mentioned that was part of the formative experience of it, that these events that you mentioned in the 19th century and after the turn of the century with the Boxer Protocols, you know, they happen at these moments of you know, kind of maximal humiliation. How does that go on to shape diplomacy all the way up to the present?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I mentioned, it's crucial to understanding the institutional foundations of the foreign ministry. And I think it's also really important to remember that for a lot of China's early diplomats, national humiliation was a lived experience. This is something that we're used to thinking of now as a kind of CCP talking point. An example that jumped out to me was Wu Jianmin, who would go on to be China's ambassador in Paris, as a kid was playing outside the French embassy in Nanjing and had a dog set on him for kind of playing out in the streets there. And, you know, the guy went on to serve in Paris and to go through this process of seeing China gradually and slowly treated like an equal. But I think that left an indelible mark on China's early diplomats. And I think it's shaped the institutional culture of Chinese diplomacy as well. You know, this idea that you need to be constantly vigilant against even the smallest slights, the smallest dismissals of China's status has been really, really crucial.
Yeah, for sure.
So you just were talking about France, and de Gaulle said nations don't have friends, only interests. But China has long used this old friend of China designation, and it still uses it, but it dates all the way back to Yan'an. Can you talk about what friendship has typically meant in China to the Communist Party and what it means now?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that I wish more people dealing with China understood. You know, this concept of friendship has a very specific meaning in Chinese foreign relations. The best definition I've heard is that it's someone who the CCP believes will give China the benefit of the doubt in their assessments of the country. So it's not necessarily someone they consider totally uncritical, but it's someone who will be given special access, opportunities to interview top leaders and visit places that others might not be able to go in exchange for maybe tempering your message a little bit. And so there have been a variety of these figures throughout PRC diplomatic history. One of the most prominent in the early days in the 1930s was the American journalist Edgar Snow. You know, Henry Kissinger has been given the title, Lee Kuan Yew got it. And, you know, I would argue that some of the influencers who have been sent to Xinjiang recently also probably fall in that broad framework of quote-unquote friendship diplomacy.
Sure, sure, for sure. I mean, these days we talk a lot about Edward Snow. The old China hands in various listservs that I'm on have been talking about him a lot because of, you know, he's been held up as the kind of model that, you know, what China, recently they've been talking about how he's the model of what they want out of a journalist. Now, when you look at his later writings on China, say after the Great Leap Famine, you know, the things like The Other Side of the River and so forth, I can see why anyone would say he looks like a dupe. He should have known better. He should have, I mean, he clearly didn't have his eyes open. He knew he was seeing Potemkin villages. But if you go back to 1936 to, you know, when he published Red Star Over China, is it really fair to judge him then as a useful idiot, as a dupe? Because, look, I mean, I would have written that book, right? You stick me in Yan'an, you know, with all that upswell of patriotism, the that spirit of sacrifice. Yan'an looked pretty damn noble back then. And what they were doing, by, you know, stark contrast to what was happening in the Kuomintang camp, looked pretty darn good. You know, all the romantic revolutionaries, you know, youth were all flocking to it. And we didn't know that the Communist Party was destined to become what it was under Mao later, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, Snow was captivated by this infectious enthusiasm that many early Chinese revolutionaries had, and a sense of optimism in the West about what communism might offer for the transformation of human societies. You know, there were Western academics and writers who went to the Soviet Union and wrote in glowing terms in kind of similar ways that we now think of as naive, but maybe it wasn't quite as clear at the time. And I think you can say that of Snow as well. I think if I kind of put my journalist hat on, the fact that Mao was able to go through word by word the transcripts of what he wrote and that his experience was so closely managed probably should have been warning signs to him.
Yeah,
but certainly it wouldn't be reasonable to have expected him to predict what would transpire in the 50s and 60s in that slightly more innocent phase of Communist Party history. You know, the party hadn't been through the rectification campaign yet. Right. Mao hadn't developed his cult of personality at that point. And so it was somewhat of a different beast, but I think there was also an element of Snow seeing what he wanted to see in the party.
I mean, you mentioned, I'm sort of slightly shaking my head because I was just thinking, Pete, you mentioned sending influencers to Xinjiang. I'm not sure if you were talking about these kind of internet influencers, but there is a whole generation of little snowlets in China now who are like vloggers on YouTube who go to Xinjiang and see only beautiful pastures and happy dancing minorities, which, you know, I mean, some of them, I don't think they're stupid, but they're for some reason slightly gullible, I suppose. There's no reason to think that Edgar Snow was, you know, any different.
Yeah, I'm even more cynical than you about these people. I suspect that they're just doing it because they're making money. I can't believe that they are just so willfully blind to some of the things that even, you know, Beijing talks about pretty openly and how unacceptable these things are. Anyway, one of those rare instances where I'm going to be more cynical than Jeremy.
I don't know. I mean, how much money can they be making? I mean, if that's what they're doing it for, that's pretty sad. Anyhow.
So, Peter, your book introduces the reader to quite a number. I mean, it's a manageable number, but of important figures in the PRC's diplomatic history. So we've talked about Zhou Enlai, but also, you know, to some of his contemporaries like Wang Jiaxiang and to Huang Hua, who was actually Edgar Snow's translator and later on went on to be, you know, foreign minister in the critical years after Zhou's death. It's really fascinating. I really enjoyed those chapters. Let's do, though, a quick rundown of the dramatis personae in the book, looking at some of these diplomats, especially in the post-Mao period, and the issues and the circumstances that they had to wrestle with, and the contributions, their diplomatic styles, their political predilections. And maybe we can skip all the way up to the 80s and start with Qian Xichun, who I think might be a good person to start with. What should we all know about Qian?
I think the first thing you should know is that when you ask people in Washington to recall their memories of him, they smile immediately,
right.
which is really telling. That is not the case if you ask them to recall their memories of Yang Jiechi. It's very it's very, very different. Qian was this kind of bright-eyed, smart, witty character who studied in the Soviet Union as a young man, was very enamored with the system when he first arrived, went back to visit later, and was kind of struck by how the society hadn't moved on in the way that he might have expected. Rose to prominence in the 80s and then really became the face of China's fight back in the wake of the Tiananmen massacre.
Right, right, right. Very important figure.
So another person, maybe you could just give us a sketch of, is Dai Bingguo, who many people like me probably believed was foreign minister, but in fact was a state counselor. But he was he played an important role in the salad days of U.S.-China relations in the Hu Wen era, and he seems to have a fairly good reputation among foreign diplomats. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, so Dai is one of those stories that kind of belongs to the history of the PRC, where you see an individual with incredible talent who genuinely wouldn't have risen to such prominence without the communist revolution. He was born into absolutely staggering poverty in the south of China. He would walk barefoot to school, and to this day he walks with a, I don't know quite how to describe it, but
a little bit of a limp
because his feet are slightly disfigured from that experience. His hair never turned fully black until he was into adulthood because of malnutrition. So he has this, you know, remarkable story and rose up through the party in the 50s and then as a junior diplomat just at the start of the Cultural Revolution. And he went on really to be, I would say, the main interlocutor for Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State, leading some of those Obama-era dialogues which were designed to introduce some stability into the U.S.-China relationship. And, you know, he was one of those figures in PRC diplomacy who was capable of taking this tight leash that Chinese diplomats are kept on and stretching it a little bit and taking official talking points and making them more palatable and appealing to his interlocutors. So he's another person, I would say, who tends to evoke quite fond memories when you ask people about him.
I guess next up we have Yang Jiechi and Wang Yi, who I think a lot of Americans will really, you know, will be fresh in their minds from the Anchorage summit. I think both of them played very big roles in the last dozen years or so. Let's talk about these two. Yang was, of course, ambassador to the U.S. and then foreign minister, and then took over the leading group on foreign affairs from Dai Bingguo. So he's very, very senior diplomat, but also known for some pretty memorable outbursts. There's quite a few of the tales of diplomatic overreach in your book in which he figures quite prominently. Talk about Yang Jiechi.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Yang is probably if you had to choose one person to personify the Chinese foreign ministry, I think it would probably be Yang. Mm-hmm. One of the arguments I make is that there has kind of been this back and forth between what we now describe as wolf warrior tactics and charm tactics at different periods of the PRC's history. And Yang is equally capable of doing both. So he was handpicked by Zhou Enlai in the 1970s as Joe was looking for a way to build ties for China and develop expertise in foreign affairs in the wake of the Cultural Revolution. He was sent off to study in England. He came back and became an America's hand. So he led George H.W. Bush on a tour of Tibet in the late 70s. He sat by Huang Hua's side, one of the most prominent foreign ministers' sides, as he delivered diatribes to the Reagan administration about Taiwan. And he developed this skill set where he would use his kind of perfect English at times to make jokes about things he had read in the New York Times culture section and, you know, kind of be funny and pithy. And at other times, he would just launch into these withering diatribes, just like he did at Anchorage. And you talk to people who have sat through those firsthand. You know, I've had people say that they just wanted to run out of the room because of the intensity of that he's capable of mustering. And he's certainly someone who evokes pretty strong emotions.
Yeah, he sure does.
Pete, let's talk about Wang Yi. He figures prominently in your book. He's debonair. He's fluent in Japanese. He has a very impressive resume. He also looks like he wouldn't be much fun to be around when he gets angry. What is his reputation and what makes him tick?
Yeah, so inside the foreign ministry, if you ask people about him, they say that, you know, Wang is a true politician, whereas Yang Jiechi is kind of more of a bureaucrat. And I think there's some truth to that. And oftentimes, you know, he got very angry with a Canadian journalist in 2016 and has kind of used wolf warrior tactics since then. And we tend to focus on those. But I think it is actually kind of interesting to step back for a second and think about the task that he was handed when Xi Jinping came to power in 2012, 2013. Arguably, I think that the most challenging task that any foreign minister has inherited since Chen Qichen in the wake of Tiananmen. You know, this was a Chinese leader who wanted to remake China's role in the world, to bring it to much greater prominence, and seems to have a preference for the foreign ministry taking on much tougher tactics than it's used to be to carrying out in the past. And Wang has handled it with great finesse, I would argue. You know, he has taken the foreign ministry's tone and made it harsher, and seems to have stayed on the right side of Xi Jinping. You know, he was promoted to that state councillor position, which provides him with a more senior rank in the government to just being foreign minister. And, you know, he's also someone who's capable of great charm when he needs to. It's just that doesn't seem to be top of Xi Jinping's list of priorities for diplomats at the moment. And so he's taken on more of the wolf warrior role in recent years.
Yeah. So we mentioned that he had been state counselor, and some of these have been in charge of the leading small group on foreign affairs. Would that be analogous to the American National Security Advisor, while foreign minister would be analogous to Secretary of State? Is that a good way to think of it?
I would think of foreign minister probably as a little bit further down the pecking order than Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. government has traditionally for the last decade plus has tried to pair up the state counselor with the Secretary of State as kind of a person of equal rank.
I see.
And Yang probably now has a role, you know, with his position on the Politburo that's a little bit more similar to National Security Advisor. I mean, obviously it's highly imperfect, but I would kind of tend to think of it in those terms.
Right. So I didn't get a chance to ask Ambassador Huang Ping about the recently departed ambassador to the U.S., Cui Tiankai. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about his tenure as ambassador and the legacy that he left.
Yeah, I mean, I think of Cui as someone who is very much in that, like, charm offensive type mold of foreign ministry figures. He rose up in the Asian affairs sort of section of the foreign ministry. He's an Asia hand, and he, when China was resetting its ties with Southeast Asia in the 1990s, Cui was one of the figures, together with Wang Yi, who was kind of helping to come up with messaging that might be appealing to that region.
Mm-hmm.
He is equally capable, you know, like, the wolf warrior tactics have existed long before Xi Jinping, and Cui is equally capable when he needs to of blasting his counterparts and getting very, very angry with people. If you read some of the accounts of the negotiations over Chen Guangcheng, when he was in the U.S. embassy, Cui was extremely angry with U.S. counterparts. And so, you know, he is also capable of kind of the withering dress down. But on the whole, he's someone who has tended to err on the side of actually wanting to persuade others of China's point of view. And, you know, interestingly, has actually publicly differed with Zhao Lijian's tactics in recent years, which really stands out as a kind of rare point of public disagreement there.
So let's talk about Zhao Lijian. I mean, so this guy, I first noticed him when he was still, I guess, relatively not a junior, but he was had a minor role in Pakistan at the mission in Karachi originally. Anyway, and then but a very vocal Twitter account. And now he's the world famous wolf warrior. What can you tell us about Zhao Lijian?
Yeah, so as you say, Zhao was a relatively obscure figure who had served in a junior capacity in Washington, but had mainly been a South Asia hand. He was deputy chief of mission in Islamabad, I think, when he started to build up this quite substantial Twitter following, which at the time was extremely unusual for a Chinese diplomat. Now it's pretty standard, but then it really, really wasn't. And he picked a fight on Twitter with former National Security Advisor Susan Rice, which in fact caught the eye of Cui Tianyi in Washington, who kind of distanced himself and kind of tacitly apologized to Rice over that spat. But it shot him to fame in China. And he was promoted to this position of foreign ministry spokesman, making him one of the most prominent faces, not just for the foreign ministry, but for the whole of the Chinese government. And he really wasn't on that track before. So it's pretty clear that promotion came as a result of these tactics that he undertook on Twitter. And since then, as you both know, things have just become more provocative and extreme as time has gone on.
Yeah.
What remind us, what year was that when he was promoted?
I want to say it was 2017. Actually, I think it was 2019 when he got into that spat. You know, for me and I think a lot of other people, the Trump administration is one long blur.
I mean, that is necessary context. It didn't come out of nowhere. We did have several years of Trump on Twitter lowering the tone.
But it was still pre-COVID, though. I mean, I still think of the Trump administration in its pre- and post-COVID, especially vis-a-vis China. But anyway, the last person we should talk about is the new ambassador who's just taken up his position in D.C., Qin Gang. Who seems to be, you know, more in the charm offensive kind of camp so far. No? Am I wrong?
I think it depends who you ask. Mm-hmm. So Qin has this background of actually being a kind of UK and Western Europe expert in the foreign ministry. So similar to Cui, not an America hand, which is a real break, actually. In the past, China has tended to appoint people who have served for lengthy stints in the US or at least at international organizations in the US to the ambassador position. After a series of appointments in Britain and dealing with Western Europe, he was appointed head of protocol, which gave him a very significant role in planning Xi Jinping's overseas trips. Lots of photos of him in high-level meetings with Xi, and he was the guy who was dealing with the real granular details of how Xi would arrive in a building and like what size the reception would be and all of these things.
If I may interrupt, we used a photo of him when the appointment was announced in a kind of golf cart with Xi Jinping in a Boeing plant near Seattle. And he was sitting behind Xi Jinping holding a red folder. So in that red folder would have been like Xi Jinping's itinerary, basically, is what you're saying.
I mean, and much more than that. Like, I mean, I have no idea what was in that folder, but he was involved in the really, really small details of Xi's visits. And as you both know, making sure that Xi is presented in a way that is seen as fitting with the stature that he has achieved in Chinese politics and in a way that promotes his image at home is absolutely central to Chinese diplomacy. And so that was a pretty hefty task for him. And he seems to have handled it in a way that was satisfactory to the boss. His next position before, he really hit a top job was as vice minister dealing with European affairs. And in that role, if you talk to European diplomats who dealt with him in Beijing, he could be pretty curt and direct. And he wasn't kind of into public wolf warrior tactics, but in private, I understand that he was. He also has, of course, as his time as foreign ministry spokesman, a great deal of media experience. And was quite fond of some pretty direct put downs of Western media too.
So one of the things, I guess, that you must be asked about constantly is, how do we understand wolf warriorness? What does it mean? What causes it? And one of the things that has become a part of that debate recently is Xi Jinping's speech earlier this summer that called on officials to present a trustworthy, lovable, and respectable image, which was interpreted in various ways. What did you make of that speech?
I thought it was really interesting. There's a great deal of art that goes into understanding any utterances from Xi Jinping, and his remarks on this were brief, so I wouldn't want to read too much into it. But what I think his remarks showed was kind of a tacit recognition that some of China's diplomatic tactics, external affairs tactics, have gone a little bit too far and have generated a backlash. But I thought what was striking about that recognition was actually the limitations placed on it, right? He was talking about telling China's story in a more effective way. He wasn't talking about policy change. And when you look now at the scale and the depth of the backlash against China in a lot of countries, where it's caused by China's industrial policies, China's policies in Xinjiang, the abolition of presidential term limits and all of these things which have kind of slowly chipped away at support for engagement with China. And without policy change, I think it's quite hard to see how just tweaking the messaging will make much difference. And actually, if you look at the Twitter accounts of Chinese diplomats in the last few weeks, I'm not even sure they've changed the messaging all that much.
I fear not. Let's talk a little bit about the source material that you used for this. I said there were interviews, obviously, that you managed to get. The most significant thing, though, I think, was these memoirs that were written by former Chinese diplomats. You've said elsewhere that you were able to find over 100 such memoirs. To what extent could they actually write freely about their experiences once out of office? I mean, how candid are these things?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't recommend them as anyone's sort of beach reading. They're pretty tough to get through. So I started out with kind of one or two, and I knew that Dai Bingguo had a memoir and that Li Jiaxing had one. And I started out looking at those, and once you get through this like turgid detail about, then there was another meeting, and that was followed by another meeting. You get some nice little kind of personal insights and asides where I started to think like, well, if I had enough of these things, maybe it could add up to something. And so I started using Baidu to just every keyword combination I could think of. And I realized that, there are loads of them. And they tend not to be published by very prominent publishing houses, so it's like Liaoning People's Press, Anhui People's Press. And I don't know how many copies most of these things sold. I can't imagine that it was very many, but a lot of them came out in the 90s and the 2000s. And you both know, like, they were great limits on what could be said and what couldn't be said even back then, but compared to now, it was a period of relative openness. And so people were kind of able to reflect within the bounds of what was allowed on their historical experiences. And oftentimes, if you took their personal reflections and lined them up with the timeline of Chinese history, it became even more interesting. So, people would talk about how in the late 1950s they were really hungry and their members of their family died. And, you could line that up with the chronology of the Great Leap Forward and start to put something together. And the same for the Tiananmen Massacre. You know, no one was able to really address it head on, but they could talk about how people would counsel on lunches for them or stand them up for meetings. And so, you know, it's kind of like taking shards of glass and trying to make something out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Are any of them at all readable?
Depends on your definition of readable. They're all quite hard work. But I would say, you know, so I really enjoyed Gung Biao's memoir and Ke Hua's memoir. So Gung was one of these PLA generals who was made into an ambassador. Uh-huh. And so you get some of the flavor of the very early foreign ministry and just how alien kind of the world of international diplomacy was to those guys. And it's also very interesting to read because one of Xi Jinping's very first jobs was as an aide to Gung in the Ministry of Defense. So when, you know, he doesn't talk about Xi in the memoir, but once you have that context, it starts to become a little bit more intriguing. The other figure who kind of on a similar note who really fascinated me, and this was by far my favorite of the memoirs, was Ke Hua, who was ambassador to London and was Xi Jinping's first father-in-law. Yeah, that marriage didn't last, but Ke was really a very bold and free-thinking guy. He went and served in London and had this, of course, very orthodox communist take on what UK society was going to be like, and he discovered the National Health Service and that his kid could get treated there for free. And, you know, he watched the start of the Thatcher Revolution and all of the strengths and weaknesses of British democracy, and he wrote cables back to Beijing saying, like, look, guys, we need to rethink this because, like, Britain is not on the verge of communist revolution. And by the way, they don't seem to be expropriating the masses in the way that we initially thought. He even wanted to write a cable about the advantages of democracy, but no one else in the embassy was willing to put their name on it, so he didn't do that. And it's that probably worked out pretty well for him, actually, given how things turned out.
If only Xi Jinping had followed his first wife to England, it would have been a very different world we'd be living in right now. I don't know if Wu Jianmin actually wrote one of these memoirs that you read, but I thought there was a quote that you included from him, which I thought was just amazingly insightful. Wu Jianmin was another one of these very, very prominent diplomats. He had been in the UN mission and served in the Netherlands as ambassador, quite a few ambassadorships that he'd had, as well as I think he was vice foreign minister. But the quote that you had from him was, "Historically, the Chinese people were bullied into being afraid, into a somewhat unhealthy mindset where they're overly sensitive to the evaluation of the outside world. If someone says we're good, we're delighted and yet all puffed up. If someone says a couple of bad things about us, we're incredibly sad or angry. It expresses a lack of confidence." This particular expression of the old Aqiu Jingsheng is very recognizable in me. I see a lot of people who are very much like this, that whole kind of the susceptibility to puffery or flattery and the sensitivity. Man, what an interesting quote, and what a time to be able. He wrote that in 2015, though, so that was already into the Xi period.
So he actually wrote a series of memoirs. It's kind of like it's a bit of a like. They're all kind of the same. You can read one of them. I read all of them, but one will suffice. But you know, he kept pushing that message of like moderation and the need for China to retain this kind of hide and bide posture that it had for so long, well into Xi Jinping's tenure. And actually, he ended up in a very prominent public spat with Hu Xijin from the Global Times, who took objection to that approach.
So the foreign ministry in China is generally considered to be a fairly weak government body, and it often has to compete with other players for influence, including the Ministry of Commerce, even state-owned enterprises, and it's kind of squeezed from all sides. What makes it so relatively weak, and is that unusual? Are there strong foreign ministries in other countries, or is that just the way it is?
Yeah, I once heard Kirk Campbell crack a joke when he said that people around him in the State Department would mention how weak the foreign ministry was, and he would kind of say, well, it takes one to know one. So, you know, I don't think that they tend to be as powerful in most political systems as ministries that are charged with the economy, or certainly in authoritarian systems as ministries which deal with internal security or the military. And it is true that the foreign ministry is kind of a weak diplomatic player in China. I do think that it's worth focusing on and one reason, which is that it kind of plays this outsized role in representing China to the world. On lots of issues, Xi Jinping and other leaders will speak in kind of these Marxist platitudes, which are very difficult for outsiders to decipher. Chinese business leaders and China's civil society, China's cultural industry is not capable of speaking out in the same way as, you know, the US equivalents are. And so you end up with this like very small number of people who articulate the government's opinion, and the foreign ministry is definitely one of those institutions. I think it's also important to try to think about how the Chinese leadership thinks of diplomacy in the Chinese system. I don't really buy this analysis which is often brought to the table, where it's like, oh, it's fighting bureaucratic institutions vying for influence. That goes on. But I think from the leadership's perspective, it's like diplomacy is one tool, the external propaganda system is another tool, the military is another one, and so, you know, so are the agencies which are charged with implementing economic coercion or providing incentives to other countries. And so they kind of choose from this litany of different things rather than being actors in the middle with you know, bureaucratic chaos swirling around them. So I guess I kind of conceptualize it slightly differently, if that makes sense.
It does. It does make sense. Yeah. So Pete, I mean, as with so many other things, when we look at China today, we have to look at Chinese diplomacy and figure out the correct proportions of continuity and change, right? Discontinuity. Your book's main thesis is that we can learn a lot about why Chinese diplomats act as they do today by looking at the formative years, the diplomatic corps under Zhou Enlai, this whole idea of, you know, Wenzhuang, Jiefangjun, PLA in civilian clothing or whatever. I think you make your case really well, but I think it's good that we also spell out some of the periods of change that you have to account for in the post-Mao period, because there are some periods in, like, for example, the pre-Olympic post-9/11 period where things go pretty swimmingly for them, and there's, you know, not a lot of wolfie going on. It seems like Chinese diplomacy takes on a very different character during these times, and there's, you know, a looser rein, yeah?
Yeah, I think for me the most important characteristic of this, like, People's Liberation Army in civilian clothing that Zhou tried to create is discipline. So when the top leadership articulates charming the world as a goal, Chinese diplomats can be pretty effective at going after it. There are always great limitations on how far they can go and how much leeway they have. But if the goal is to win over foreign opinion and the objectives are thought of in quite a limited way, like, you know, we need to remove sanctions against China in the wake of the Tiananmen crackdown, and we want to host the Olympics, then actually Chinese diplomats can be incredibly effective at going after that goal. When the priorities of the leadership change and focus more on ideology and cracking down on internal dissent and party orthodoxy, Chinese diplomats tend to respond in a way which stops putting foreign opinion front and center of what they're doing and starts to kind of look at what the top leadership wants. And that happened under Mao, and I would argue that it's also happening now under Xi.
Yeah, and we'll get to that. But how common really is it for in other countries to see a diplomatic corps, a foreign ministry, deviate at all from the line set by the PM or by the president or you know, whatever autocrat is in charge? I mean, isn't it kind of the norm for diplomats to be, you know, like really all about message discipline? I can't imagine that there are states where it's the norm for them to, you know, to veer wildly off script.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally a sliding scale, and clearly having people freelancing all over the place equally wouldn't be an effective approach toward diplomacy. I guess in China, it comes down to the degree of stringency which is expected of Chinese diplomats. You know, I remember talking to one of my interviewees was Chaz Freeman, who I know you guys have spoken to on the show before, and he talked about diplomacy as this kind of art of persuasion and this ability to take a set of relatively well-defined talking points and use your cultural knowledge of the place where you're based and the historical context that you've garnered over time and the mood in the room to kind of massage those messages in a way that's going to be persuasive to others. And I think that at their very best, US diplomats can be extraordinarily effective at doing that.
Yeah.
It's not the case in every, you know, with every person, but they can be really, really very effective. I don't think Chinese diplomats are any less talented, but they are given far less room to run on that. And I think it's to the detriment of China's diplomacy, really.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
The only room to run right now seems to be on Twitter, where anything goes. If China's diplomacy has changed a lot with the United States, it's changed even more when it comes to middle powers, or at least the Western ones like Australia and Canada. Can you talk about Beijing's middle power diplomacy? Or maybe we shouldn't, diplomacy is the wrong word. Maybe we should call it, you know,
foreign
middle
policy.
Power kick in the assery or something. you know, how should we understand what's going on with Australia and Canada?
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's a cliche, but it's true that Beijing, above all, responds to power in the international system, right? And when Chinese diplomats need to talk to their US counterparts, they might get pretty snippy and they may deliver some public lectures, but there's always going to be this limit placed on their behavior by the fact that the US has the most powerful military in the world and this dynamic economy that China needs to trade and interact with. And that limit is not there when Chinese diplomats are interacting with the UK or Canada or Australia. And so the behavior can go so much further. Just because, you know, the consequences are smaller. And I think in some ways those countries have become a little bit of a stage for Chinese diplomats to signal their loyalty back to the party center without the massive repercussions that would come with behaving the same way toward the US.
So Pete, there is one thing, I mean, just with caveat that I really did think the book was fantastic, but there was one thing I did want to push back on a bit, or maybe, you know, get your take on how you square this. Because for most of the book, you encourage us to believe that China's diplomatic corps is very much defined by this strict discipline, their unfailing ability to just stay on message, not deviate at all from the party line. And you offer all sorts of examples about how the foreign ministry just, you know, bears that same stamp from its very earliest days when they were building diplomatic capacity just from scratch. So all this is supposed to lead us to an understanding of why China's diplomacy has taken such a hard turn and become so, you know, so pugnacious and so strident. That's the promise in the title, right? You know, the making of wolf warrior diplomacy. But it's exactly these early wolf warrior episodes that stand out from everything else you discussed, because they're not pre-approved. They're individual initiative. Some of these, you know, real pugilists like, you know, Zhao Lijian. And sometimes they even get dressed down. I mean, I guess as I was you know, reading the book, as we were approaching the Trump era, I expected that you were going to present evidence that, you know, Zhao Lijian's outbursts were actually authorized, that they were scripted, they were planned, they were by the book. But you actually say quite the opposite. They weren't. That they were, so, you know, a cause for division. So where did that famous discipline that you'd spent the first 4/5 of the book, you know, convincing of us suddenly fly off to?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think the Cultural Revolution as a explanation for what's going on now in Chinese politics often, usually falls short, but actually is really instructive in this case. Huh. So the discipline that was built up in the foreign ministry is very consistent, but there have been periods when it's been challenged a great deal, usually by what's happening in elite politics. So in the Great Leap Forward, the fact that Chinese diplomats were very, very hungry drove them to steal food from the foreign ministry cafeteria and take food from diplomatic receptions to feed their children, and they were punished for doing so. And then much, much more dramatically in the Cultural Revolution, as Mao launched this kind of grassroots political movement aimed at upending political authority in China and transforming Chinese society, Chinese diplomats found themselves kind of out in front of where the ministry's leadership had got itself to. And I think that maybe what's going on now is not the same as that, but maybe it rhymes with it, right? Like Xi set this incredibly assertive tone for Chinese diplomacy and these very high expectations about the degree of deference that China would be shown in the world and how it wouldn't truck opposition from any quarter, at home or abroad. And I think that in some ways, individual Chinese diplomats like Zhao worked toward that goal in a way that was maybe a little bit faster than the ministry's leadership. And so I kind of see that breakdown in discipline as being very, very similar to what happened in the Cultural Revolution.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. I mean, it's the spirit and not the letter of instruction, right?
That
seemed to be. It reminds me, I don't know if you've ever read Ian Kershaw's biographies of Hitler, not to suggest that there's anything similar between Xi and Hitler, but there's this idea he introduces called
many working, work, Kaiser. need to.
Not me. Very clear. Working toward the Führer. I mean, this is not a particular German example either. I mean, we see this all, in a lot of places where there's this sort of interpretation of what the leader wants and then people sort of work toward. I even use the phrase work toward, right? That's... Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I mean, you will indeed find the phrase "work towards Xi Jinping's wishes" in my book. I guess people say like if you want to lose an argument, bring up the Second World War, right? So like
Godwin's Law.
I didn't go for it directly, but I did use. I did use some of that idea, but. You know, what I think is really interesting about the Wolf Warrior phenomenon, especially as it plays out on Twitter, is how in some ways it's really antithetical to the broader Xi Jinping project, right? Like Xi is about party discipline, ideological conformity, promoting a vigorous Leninist system for China. And having freelancing diplomats on social media is really not the look that he's going for in general, whether you look at his approach to the economy, foreign policy, propaganda, et cetera, et cetera. And so I do think that there will probably be this moment where the place that the bureaucracy gets to comes into line with what she expects. And I would assume that we'd see a little bit less freelancing at that point. I don't necessarily think it means a softening of tone. She seems to like the tough tone, but I think maybe we'll see a little bit more uniformity.
I don't know. I mean, as long as it's continuing to play well at home to the, you know, to the Xiao Feihong or whatever, then it may not be kiboshed too quickly.
Yeah, and there's a lot of sort of state media journalists whose main job seems to have become to be Twitter trolls who might take up the mantle if the diplomats are prohibited from speaking up themselves.
Yeah.
Pete, can we talk about the United Nations, where China does seem to be focusing a lot of effort? What do you make of China's activities in the UN? Is its UN diplomacy effective? And how is this going to be changed by the pandemic?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I guess that China sort of thinks of the UN as a venue where it can make headway when perhaps other venues are closed down, right? Like, so the bilateral relationship with the US and to some extent Europe is a little bit stuck. But the UN, because of the role of the General Assembly, is an area of great international importance where China can make its case and feel heard. It's also, you know, China has a preference, I think, for international institutions which promote quite a traditional view of sovereignty and, you know, don't talk too much about universal values and things that go on beyond the traditional remit of nation states. And so China kind of sees the UN in that mold and I think sees a way to reinforce its worldview using an international institution, if that makes sense. There's also been, you know, China introducing resolutions to have Xi Jinping phrases introduced and to kind of build the international legitimacy of Xi there. So
another thing I'd like to get your take on is the interview Kaiser did with Ambassador Huang Peng, the consul general in New York, which was, quite a tough thing to do. You know, I was a little bit involved in looking at the questions in advance, and it's really tough to get an answer out of a Chinese diplomat when they're prepared for a media interview. I mean, they don't really say anything that you couldn't write yourself, actually, if you pay attention to what Chinese diplomats say. I believe, Pete, after all the research you've done, you could have totally scripted Ambassador Huang Peng's answers. But you listened to it. Am I wrong? Did anything stick out or surprise you? Or
Thinking of getting in a Twitter spat with Susan Rice and seeing if I can get myself promoted to the spokesman job, actually.
Do it. I can channel Jolly Jian pretty well.
But yeah,
Seriously, though, anything stick out for you from that interview?
So I thought that he was at his most compelling when he spoke about his personal story, right? Like his humble origins, the opportunities he'd got through the diplomatic service, the process of learning that China went through. And in many ways, that is the best story that the party state's got going for it. And he told it reasonably well. It was tough for him when it got into the questions about Xinjiang and Taiwan, because there is so little space for deviation there. And he's
like,
got a list
as
of
in
points.
Little space, meaning no space at all, like zero zilch.
Yeah, I think that would be a reasonable way of summing it up. I thought that that was he kind of made an admirable effort, and he kind of came to the table with a set of messages which had been pretty well defined by Yang Jieqi and Wang Yi. Right, it's that they tried to offer the US a little get out clause from the escalating tensions in the relationship by saying, like, oh, you know, welcome you guys. Like, last guy was crazy. We see that. Things seem to have gone bad, but we're all good now, right? That would be kind of my summary of some of the early speeches that Yang and Wang Yi made. And they've been pretty shocked, I think, to find that the Biden administration is not in that mood at all. I kind of saw the interview when it got to US-China as a little bit of a reincarnation of those early speeches from Yang and Wang.
Yeah, I absolutely thought so. I think that was exactly what I had expected. And, you know, part of me wanted to sort of give him the opportunity to say exactly that. And he rose to it there. I think it was interesting, though, that how you know, you talk about how scripted they are. He used language exactly from Yang Jieqi's responses on things like Wolf Warrior diplomacy. You know, this stuff about, you know, we don't bully anyone, we don't do things, but we have spine, or I think he said we have bones, we have guts. He actually used the word guts. It's not something that colloquially, you know, Chinese people learn right away in English. But what did you make of that? I mean, I thought it was remarkable that, you know, he seems to have like actually studied what was acceptable language coming from other people on that topic.
Yeah, so I definitely recognize the language. I asked Wang Yi that a very similar question at the MPC a few years ago and prompted like an almost identical set of words from him in response. You know, one of the things that US kind of veterans of dealing with China talk about with their Chinese interlocutors is this remarkable institutional memory that they have and the incredible recall they have for official talking points. You know, so you could turn a Chinese diplomat round in circles in Times Square, say the word Taiwan, and you would get a pitch perfect reply on the PRC's position. You know, it's
any one of us could do that now. Right? we know it. We've heard it all so many times. I even tried. I gave him this. I used this. How would you state the American position on? Not, you know, so that he didn't have to put it in his own words, but he wouldn't even do that. That was interesting that he couldn't really. I knew he knew exactly what I was saying.
And surely you weren't surprised by any of this, Kaiser. I mean, you're not naive.
I thought there maybe that he would be in a safe space where he could say, you know, this isn't my opinion.
A
here
safe
on this
space? You're kidding me.
Well, I'm an old friend of China.
One last question, or another question, Pete. If we've gone into quite some detail about various characters and some of the ideas that animate your book, but if I was going to look for a soundbite, how should we understand the utterances of Chinese diplomats? Like when we see them on the news, or we see their remarks reported in a news report, how should we listen to them?
I think the key is to remember that domestic politics is always king for Chinese diplomats. So their first, second, and third audiences are in Beijing, and you are somewhere way down the list, even if they're talking to your news channel or in a bilateral meeting with you.
Or on a podcast.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, I'll remember that.
And that answers some of your questions about your recent guest, Kaiser, I think.
Indeed it does. Peter, thank you so much for taking the time. I really enjoyed the book. It has to have been, I think, the most effortlessly readable book that I've come across in quite some time. I learned a ton, found it really engaging, and really enjoyed, interacting with the ideas in it. So congrats.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Look forward to have you back on the show. But let's move on to recommendations. First, a very quick reminder that the Cynica podcast is powered by SubChina. And if you like the work that we do with this show, or China Stories, or any of the other many shows in our network, the way to show your support is to subscribe to our SubChina Access newsletter. Isn't that right, Jeremy?
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
That is absolutely right, and that's why I was nearly getting distracted, because we have a deadline, because we got to summarize the news for our members every day. Let's get on with the show, Kaiser.
Yeah, I won't keep you too much longer. Recommendations, you go first.
Yeah, so before I moved to the United States, there were certain American animals that were always, extremely exotic to me. I grew up in Africa, so rhinos and cheetahs were sort of not that exotic, but armadillos and hummingbirds are just pretty amazing. And so this summer I've discovered hummingbird feeders, which you just fill with sugar water, basically, that you can make in the kitchen. And quite large sections of the United States have hummingbirds, and they're just gorgeous little creatures that buzz like little helicopters, and it feels to me like little books, comic books I used to read as a kid.
So your recommendation is hummingbirds?
Is buy hummingbird feeders.
Ah, okay.
And
okay.
Fill them with sugar water. Yeah.
I see. Okay.
If you live in certain parts of the United States, which is most of the East, I think.
You know what? I had an animal show up that I wasn't expecting, which I've seen all sorts of animals in my neighborhood, but we've got a groundhog living nearby.
Nice.
Fat little groundhog. I've been seeing him scurrying around. It's pretty funny. Anyway, Pete, what do you have for us?
So, yeah, I went on a long drive recently and listened to this podcast series called Dolly Parton's America. You can probably hear I'm not native to this land. And it just has got these... First, you come off with the impression that Dolly Parton is just this songwriting genius who really had a whole new appreciation for her process, but it's got these incredible asides about race in America, class, gender, the history of the banjo, all kinds of wonderful and unexpected things. So that's my recommendation.
I totally second that, and completely. As an actual Tennessean, it's fantastic, really, really wonderful.
She is an absolute national treasure, and her take on Americana is just. Yeah, it's wonderful. Yay. All right. Okay, mine is just a film that I saw. First time I went back into a movie theater since the pandemic, I went with my daughter to see this new film, The Green Knight. Have you guys heard of this? It's an adaptation, very close, very faithful, not perfectly faithful, to, the chivalric romance from the 15th century. It's really, it's pretty amazing. Or 14th century. It's pretty amazing. It's the Arthurian story of The Green Knight. Visually, it's stunning. It may move a little slowly for some people in parts, but it's a really interesting take. We walked away just, you know, thinking about it for a very long time. So
you went to see it in a theater?
In a theater, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not scared of Delta?
I wore a mask, and so did my daughter. So
okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So that's it. Peter, thank you once again.
Thank
Fantastic.
You. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, the book was great. I'm really glad that we could do this. The book, once again, is called China's Civilian Army, The Making of Wolf Warrior Diplomacy, and give it a read. All right. Jeremy, great to see you, man.
Yep.
And Pete, thanks once again.
Thanks so much.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced and edited by me, Kaiser Guo. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.